Hello there, ladies and gentlemen of the CaperCast audience. Thank you for coming. This is Jim Brown speaking. At the conclusion of last week's talk, I mentioned the death of my old friend Joe Hudson. It's kind of a downer, all right. But I'm going to try to turn it upwards here because that was the nature of our 55 years of friendship. Right from the start, we knew we had a pretty special connection. And this time, I'm going to tell you how it started. But I'll also try to tell you how it fits in, what the context is. And that results from a book I've been reading called TED Talk. It's written by that guy, Chris Anderson, who runs the TED Talk phenomenon. It's storytelling conferences worldwide now. And this book is really a guide to public speaking. It's helped me realize the disorganized, gobbledygook manner in which I've presented my stories to you here. It moves me first to thank you for your patience. So I'm going to try to organize this story according to one of the simplistic formulae in this book. I'll try to explain what happened and why that might matter and how that influences what happens next. The formula goes, what? So what? Then what? And I frankly don't remember whether I've told you this story before. I'm sure there are some of you who haven't heard it. And incidentally, it really does have a little something to do with the advent of the modern multi-hull. And it does lead to other stories about how this guy, Joe Hudson, the cartoonist who illustrated many of my early Sea Runner publications, eventually was to own 9 of my designs. I really don't believe there ever would have been a Sea Runner Trimarans without Joe Hudson's cartoons. I called him the old fear fighter because he could actually take the dread, the fear, out of an amateur building a seagoing boat with the prospect of actually going to sea in it. He would address that hesitation by poking fun at it in his cartoons. It was very effective. If you would like to see some of that work, please go to www.outrigmedia.com. If you noodle around there, you'll find a place where you can order a free download of the Sea Runner Construction Manual. Many of his best cartoons are in that book. And he certainly did sail them around. And I need to tell it anyway for a little personal therapy. It's about how I first met Joe Hudson for the second time. Okay, here we go. We were living in Ralph Newell's barn. It was literally a one-horse barn perched on the mountainside, about 700 feet above the surf, just high enough to be above most of the morning fog, and we were right on the edge of a dense redwood canyon. It was very steep so that the trees below us started far enough down that we were actually living in the canopy, looking out into the midst of the redwood growth, so that from our little barnyard, which we had turned into kind of a patio, we had a very boreal feeling. The redwoods were so thick that we couldn't see the surf, but we could now and then hear it. One of Ralph Newell's sons had fixed the place up to be semi-habitable. But believe me, it was pretty crude. For instance, one wall of the bathroom was bare earth. It was the actual excavation where a big backhoe had dug out enough of the mountain to perch this little barn in there. Our firstborn son, Stephen, was about 1.5 years old. So this was after Joanna and I had made that trip down the Mexican seaboard in our little trimaran, Juana. Must have been about 1962, Big Sur, California. We had become a bit weary of the Sausalito houseboat scene. It had been a great place for us to meet and to start our family. But we bumped into a guy up there, Mr. Guido Turnison, who was kind of interested in trimarans, and he talked us into moving down to Big Sur. I was working now and then for the local rancher, doing mostly construction. Joanna was raising Stephen, and pregnant with our second son, Russell. Before we left Sausalito, I had made an arrangement with Arthur Piver to sell plans for him on commission. Hadn't sold any yet. But our costs were very low. Joanna had worked it out so that she only had to go the 70 miles to town once about every 5 or 6 weeks. I made and bottled our own beer. We had an old Chevrolet station wagon that would make the mountain. It was about a 2-mile rough dirt low gear climb to get up to this place. And I guess our only real extravagance was our dogs. We had 2 German Shepherds and a Malamute. They and we ate a lot of venison. And I must say we were quite pleased with ourselves living in a very frontiersy situation. And with Arthur Piver's help, I was lucky enough to get a commission to build a 24-foot Nugget trimaran for a client in Los Angeles and arranged to rent a part of Ralph Newell's other barn, which was over on the other side of the canyon. So I started spending my days over there building a boat on this mountainside. We did have electric power and plenty of mountain water, but there was no communication, and so as Joanna's birthing time approached, we became concerned about how she would contact me if she went into labor. Well, I showed her how to put the shotgun up against a tree and pull the trigger. In the end, she didn't have to do that. I came home late one afternoon. She said as how she thought she might be going into labor, but we'd better sit down and have a Manhattan first before heading for town. So when we came back, we had, 2 kids and 3 dogs and a boat to build. Over there at the boat-building barn, I could look out and see the ocean. The horizon was perhaps 40 miles out. And sometimes, when the sky was clear and that northwester was blowing hard, looking out on the sea was so beautiful that you almost had to shield your eyes from it. And, of course, we had the dream of one day owning a boat of our own that was big enough for the 4 of us that we could be sailing down that coast under such condition. It only took about 10 years for us to make that happen. But anyway, I came home for lunch one day and we were hanging out on our little patio. I was scratching the ears of our great dog Bosco, 105 pounds, half German Shepherd, half coyote. God, he was a wonderful brute. The guy I got him from, I asked him, I said, gee whiz, any dog I ever saw would try to kill a coyote. How did you get a coyote, half-coyote puppy? And he said, oh, it's easy. You just take a female in heat and stake her out in the hills. Well, all of a sudden, Bosco stiffened, went to the edge of the patio, looked down into the canyon, and started barking. That got the other dog's attention, and they started barking. And I could hear something going on down there in the canyon. The dogs leapt over the edge, went scrambling down through the redwoods, just raising hell, making a lot of noise. And pretty soon, looking down there through the boles of these enormous trees, I could see 2 guys scrambling up the hill. It was so steep they were on all 4s. The dogs got to them, and they just yelled back at the dogs and brushed them out of the way and kept coming. They had big dogs on 3 sides of them, but they just kept coming up the mountain. I was quite surprised. I asked Joanna to take the baby inside, and I went and got my rifle and stood it inside the barn door. Yeah, we had a big barn door. When we opened it up, it opened up half the side of the house. And I just hung there watching these guys coming. And finally, they climbed over the little stone wall that surrounded the patio and stood there breathlessly looking at me. One of them said to me, you're Jim Brown, right? And I said, yeah. He said, we want to talk to you about trimarans. Well, okay, that's the what of it. It was actually the second time I had met Joe Hudson for the first time. It was years later when he finally convinced me that we had met previously up in Sausalito. I hadn't remembered. He had to jog my memory. We had met at the old Nunes Brothers boatyard there in Hurricane Gulch, Sausalito. There were many famous yachts came out of the Nunes Brothers yard, including the Zaca, a big, beautiful schooner built for the movie actor Errol Flynn. The place had long since closed up, but was being used as sort of a maker's space. I rented a little shop in there for building my second Frolic, the 16-foot Piver Frolic. It was sort of the San Francisco equivalent of the Herreshoff Museum in Bristol, Rhode Island. Bunch of rambling sheds. After being prodded for a while, I remembered that a couple of guys had come in there and asked me a question about what I was doing, and one of them just happened to be Joe Hudson. That was before I'd even met Joanna. Of course, now Hurricane Gulch is a bunch of fancy condos and apartments that are hanging out over the water, including Sally Stanford's famous old restaurant, the Valhalla. Sally was a famous San Francisco madam. I knew her briefly. She had turned to quite a floozy. But anyway, that's the what of this story. It's how I met Joe Hudson for the first time, the second time. So now, how about the so what? Well, let's jump back to Big Sur. One of the guy that was with Joe as they climbed over our patio wall there in the Big Sur Canyon, the other guy's name was Michael New. And his sister, Jenny, was Joe Hudson's girlfriend at the time, great girlfriend who did a lot of sailing with him. And Michael was, his girlfriend was a young up-and-coming folk singer named Joan Baez. And they were all living down there at Slate's Hot Springs, which has since become the famous Esalen Institute. The place was getting pretty seedy by then, but there were some little shacks on stilts around that people who wanted to come and soak in the tubs could then go back to their room and come back the next day and so on. Nice, hot, sulfur water. And so Joe and Michael decided they were going to build a 30-foot Piver Nimble trimaran. And they were going to build it, you know, 50 miles from town. No harbors around. But they figured they could take it down the Big Sur highway to a place called Lime Kiln Creek, where there was a road that went down to the beach. None of the state parks had been developed by that time, and the road was two lanes, really rough, made out of patches. It had been all put in by the CCC boys during the Depression. The road was just a scratch on this precipitous mountain slope, the steepest coastal slope in the contiguous 48. So they started building this boat down at Slate's, and after they got the hull together and were coming along, they invited me and Joanna and our boys to come down there for a little cookout. I guess it was about 50 miles south of where we were living, straight up the mountain from Deachin's Inn, if anybody knows Big Sur. We were straight up that canyon just south of Deachin's Inn. So we went down there to see the progress, and we were sitting around, you know, eating hamburgers and drinking beer and talking blah-bitty-blah. And somebody mentioned that a big storm had washed out the road to the beach at Limekiln. It was really bad news to Joe and Michael. Oh, back up a bit, incidentally, I had sold them their plans as a Piver agent and collected the check and noticed that the check was signed by Joan Baez. She was just starting to become known. She had recently just blown the place apart at Central Park in New York at a concert. So I sent the check up the Marin County to the Pivers, and the Piver daughters, who were teenagers at the time, saw the check, found the signature on there, and they wouldn't let their parents cash that check for the world, man. That was that was Joan Baez's signature. I don't know whether they still have it or not. So anyway, that night we learned that the road to Limekiln Beach had been washed out, and it was kind of a bummer. Boy, how in the world were these guys going to get this boat in the water? But they resolved to keep on building it, and just knew it would work out somehow, even if they had to lower it down the cliff. Incidentally, it was that night that, after it got cold, we went inside and were sitting around in this little shack, and Joni started playing for us, boy, and it was extremely powerful. her voice was, you know, just a real amplified blast with that almost mathematical vibrato, obviously the result of classical training. And to watch her right hand on those guitar strings, it was a marvelous sight. And she practically blew the walls out of that shack that night. It was a marvelous thing to hear. But she didn't want a thing to do with the boat. She had a dread fear of nausea. She'd apparently had a bad bout of it at some point in her life and choked on it or some such. I don't know, but she didn't want to have anything to do with the boat, but she helped Michael and Joe to build it. And of course, I had a chance to look over the project now and then during its construction. It must have been, I don't know, maybe a year later when the launching dilemma became serious. Well, it just so happened that about that time, the California Highway Department was replacing the old redwood trestles on the Big Sur Highway with concrete bridges. And one of the last of the old redwood trestles was located over Dolan Creek Canyon, just to the north of Joe Hudson's residence, which happened to be on a mountainside, which was, as I mentioned before, straight up the hill from Esalen Institute. Joe's father had a place down there on the highway. He and his friends were avid hunters, and so they had bought this mountainside for peanuts just to make themselves a place to go hunting. Joe's dad, Bill, was a prosperous Monterey lawyer, but they just loved living down there on the South Coast. So anyway, the contractor that was to build this bridge needed sand for backfill and for mixing concrete to pour the pylons for this bridge. And so the contractor approached Joe's father for permission to doze a road down to the beach in order to get sand. The highway at that point was only about 200 feet vertical above the surf. But of course the road would have to be at least half a mile long to get down there. And old Bill Hudson rubbed his hands and said, "Sure, you can cut a road down to my beach just so long as you launch my kid's boat in the process." So they cut the road, they finished the boat, it was about to happen. Well, Joe and I walked down the road and we noticed that there was one very tight turn that had to get around a huge rock that was protruding from the mountainside. The rock must have been, you know, as big as a bungalow. And the guy that was driving the dozer figured he just didn't dare try to cut that rock out of the mountain. And so he managed to get the road around it, but it was a very tight turn. And it was precipitous, vertical rock on one side and an almost vertical drop on the other side. And we looked the whole thing over, talked to the contractor guy, and we all agreed that it was going to be necessary to put the boat in its cradle on a big lowboy. They had an equipment transporter there, a lowboy, and they loaded the boat on that trailer so that the main hull was on the right side, the starboard side of the trailer, almost on the very edge of the trailer, so that most of the boat, that is, the main hull and the port float was on the trailer, but the starboard float was hanging way out over the canyon. And with that arrangement, they figured maybe they could get this equipment transporter down the road. Well, the transporter weighed a whole lot more than the boat, and so to make sure they had traction for moving the whole rig, they towed it with a cement mixer that was half full of water for ballast. And when the day came, holy moly, to see that rig start down that road, it was like we were all ready to swallow our tongues, you know. And with great good fortune, they did get the boat around that rock. But I'll tell you, the rub rail on the port float was scraping the rock itself, and the tires on the outside of the turn, the tires of the cement mixer, were causing the shoulder to crumble, you know, rocks rolling down in the canyon. Oh, man, it was really tight. But they got it down there, and they even brought a little truck crane down there, and they were able to pick up the boat, lift it off of the trailer with its cradle, and put it down on the sand at low tide, just above the swash from the surf. Now, the day before, a friend of Joe's had managed to take a kayak and an anchor out beyond the surf line and set that anchor, and they had a long piece of floating polypropylene line coming into the beach. They got that line up on the boat, and they got the contractor's little bulldozer down there behind the cradle with a 30-foot redwood timber. I'll never forget this beautiful piece of wood. It was 8 inches by 16 inches by 30 feet long. It had come out of the bridge, you know, and as a matter of fact, Joe managed later to get a hold of some of those wonderful bridge timbers for building his house up on the mountain. But anyway, we tied one end of that timber under the boat at the cradle, at the back end of the cradle, and the other end in the blade of the bulldozer. Joe and Michael got up on the bow, got a hold of that line, and as the tide started to come in, the bulldozer started grinding away. And this boat started sliding. You know, the beach was part sand and part cobble and some big rocks in the sand. And I'll be darned, the cradle uncovered a rock in the sand and started tumbling the rock under the cradle. And the next thing we knew, the cradle had fallen apart and the boat was flopped down onto the sand. Surf was breaking into the blade of the bulldozer. The guy had to back up. And now it was up to the tide. And it took a while, but the waves finally started coming in enough to lift the boat. And Joe and Michael pulled like hell. And the boat had moved forward a few feet and then ground again, you know, as the wave went by. And it went through two or three hops like that. And then came a nice big wave, and whoa, and off she went. Man, they got that thing out there onto that anchor, and everybody was just so tremendously relieved. It was responsible for that wonderful cartoon that Joe drew, showing us this boat coming down a cliff and this guy on the beach hollering, "Yahoo!" And incidentally, we've got a picture of that whole scenery. You could have a look at outrig.org at the Outrig videos. Outrig.org has a list of Outrig videos, and there's a bunch of little videos that go with each chapter in my book on Among the Multihulls. And it's in one of those early chapters. I can't remember. If you go to the video for that chapter, you'll see pictures of that boat going around that rock and going out through the crashing surf. Oh, man. Those were definitely the days of the can-do spirit. So what? Well, there's just another example of what can be accomplished with commitment, youth, and an almost maniacal dedication to the very notion of the modern multihull. And eventually, Joe and Ginny and Michael sailed that boat to Australia. That's what. And in my videotape collection, I have at least a half an hour of Joe Hudson telling about that voyage, how it came about that they made it all the way down there to Australia. And then, of course, the then what of it is to be told in other capers of how Joe influenced me and so many others, the lifestyle of the advent of the modern lightweight seafaring multihull. And I'm telling you that those stories go on for over 50 years and 9 different multihulls. And I'll hope to share some of them with you as we go along in Jim Brown's Outrig Capercast. Holy moly. Hey, here's to you, old friend. Sail on, Joey. Sail on.